The following is an encore episode of Hour 1 of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
You've tuned to the Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Hello and welcome to the Turley Frequency. I'm your host, Kevin Turley, and for the next 2 hours, we will be edifying as much as we are entertaining, I hope. Today on the show, we meet the Catholic composer, Mark Nowakowski, who is topping the music charts with his latest disc, Metanoia. We speak to Mark in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you are invited to join us. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. The lines are open right now. In the final segment today, we continue to examine the life of Sister Wilhelmina Lancaster, the nun who has returned from the grave, quite literally, and is hitting the headlines. Stick around to the last segment to find out more about this unusual and perhaps very holy woman. Okay, with all that good stuff, let's get this show on the road. Well, he came, he saw, and he's getting on a flight back to California. Yes, Prince Harry turned up in court yesterday for his second day in court, and by all accounts said very little, which would convince any judge of anything, but that's for other people to decide. He's been roundly lampooned in the media over this side. Most people are scratching their heads as to why he has done this. All sorts of theories are emerging. And no doubt the truth will out in due course, but it does seem like a very, very, at this point, a very, very expensive use of his time and his air miles to come all the way back to London for what happened yesterday. But all shall be revealed. Remember, the theme or the themes this week that we're exploring are around pride and vanity. Yeah, pride and vanity. In this month of the Sacred Heart, a heart which is humble and loving, full of divine mercy, we are looking at the corollary of that, pride and vanity, which seems to be all around us, and in some quarters is celebrated even during this month. Now, remember what we found out yesterday from the Bible when it comes to pride in the book of Proverbs, chapter 11, verse 2, when pride comes, then comes disgrace. Or Proverbs 18, verse 12, before his downfall, a man's heart is proud. You see, pride and vanity, they tend to take us to places that we shouldn't really go. I've never known anybody who has suffered from pride and vanity that has ended up in a good place. As opposed to humility and modesty, lots of humble people and modest people do very well because they're naturally likable. Proud people tend to be the people you shy away from. And as for the vain, well, they hardly notice you're there at halftime. They're so obsessed with their own image or their own mirror or whatever it happens to be that they are looking into. But pride and vanity comes in all sorts of strange ways. Now, I'm sure that the L.A. Dodgers, the sad and sorry tale of the L.A. Dodgers and their flirtation with the culture of death, has reached your ears. It has even come this side of the Atlantic to some extent, even though baseball is largely a mystery to Europeans. But I have been following it, obviously, and I'm well aware that LA Dodgers, they invited a group of, shall we say, Catholic hitters, people who wanted to mock our holy faith. And then they, after the initial furore, they decided to cancel that. And then they had to re-invite them, no doubt, because of pressure from other quarters. And the event is still going ahead. But listen, don't take my half-baked European views on this. Let's hear from somebody who knows LA, somebody who knows the United States, and somebody who understands something of what is going on here. Mike, I wonder if we could play Bishop Barron on Twitter speaking about the LA Dodgers.
Yeah, here we go. Got it all queued up for you there.
Hey everybody, it's Bishop Barron. I'm sure by now you've all heard about this controversy involving the LA Dodgers and the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. You know, the Dodgers invited this group, which I think can only be described as an anti-Catholic hate group, invited them to be honored at the Dodger Stadium. Then when there was a howl of protest from Catholics and others, they disinvited them, good move. But then they re-invited them, and the re-invitation was accompanied by a kind of pathetic apology where they were praised for all the great work that they do. Now look, I'm not going to go into all the details. Look them up on YouTube or something. You'd find what they do. I'll give you one example. I think it was on Easter Sunday. There was a display where they have Jesus on the cross, so the most sacred moment in history for Catholics. And a drag queen comes in and kind of pulls Jesus off the cross, then does a sort of pole dance on the cross. For Catholics, it's hard to imagine anything more offensive than that. Suppose this group had dressed up in a kind of simulacrum of a rabbi and had done something deeply disrespectful to the Torah, or take it a step further, had dressed up in a, you know, mockery of a Muslim cleric or imam, and then had desecrated the Quran. What would the reaction be? You know, those questions answer themselves, but somehow attacking Catholics in this most disgraceful way is okay. Not only okay, it should be honored. You know, everybody, I've said this before, but there's a long tradition in our country of anti-Catholicism. It was said famously, oh, about a century ago, the last acceptable prejudice in America is anti-Catholicism. But we shouldn't tolerate it. One thing I would say, since the Dodgers clearly are not responding to a decent appeal to reason, I'd encourage my friends back in L.A. Look, I was auxiliary bishop for 6 years in L.A. I threw out the first pitch at a Dodgers game a few years ago. But I'd encourage my friends back there, boycott the Dodgers. May I say, too, especially my Hispanic friends, many of whom are big baseball fans out there, this is your religion. This is the religion of your family, of your abuela and abuelo, of your familia, your tradición. Why are we tolerating this? We shouldn't be tolerating it. So let's pray, everybody. Let's pray for the defense of our faith, and let's stand for the Catholic faith.
Thank you, Mike. Well, Bishop Barron has said it loud and clear, I think, there. He gave a very good summation of the situation and the sorry state of the LA Dodgers, who obviously don't know where they are coming from. If this is a baseball team, I don't know which way the ball is flying, in their direction or away from them. They invite something which they obviously don't really know what it is, and then they disinvite it because of justifiable concerns. And then, because of pressure applied to them, probably behind the scenes, they decide to reinvite the group that they disinvited, and they're reinviting them because of, quotes, all their good work, close quotes. What good work. And now the LA Dodgers are in a position where they please no one. Nobody likes weakness. Nobody likes somebody or some organization that doesn't seem to have any values, but flip-flops. It's like the proverbial piece of reed in the wind. It blows whichever way the winds are blowing, and that seems to be the LA Dodgers. Now, I am not a baseball fan in the sense that I don't know a lot about baseball. I'm sure I would be a baseball fan if I did. But what I do know is baseball is a very important part of the fabric of American society. Americans do love their baseball, and they love to talk about it, and they love the iconography around it. And I get all that. It's a bit like cricket here in England. It's got that same vibe. But I can say this, that if I had an LA Dodgers hat, I would be putting it in the fire. Of course, I would have to film it and put it on Twitter and make sure everybody knew about it. But that's what I would do if I had a fire and if I had an LA Dodgers hat. But what I'm suggesting is that there is something going on here, which is a good thing. Now, it may not seem good because these people are still going to mock our faith. And listen, this isn't people simply dressing up as nuns and flouncing around the place. The sort of things that they are doing are absolutely satanic. I won't repeat them on air at this time in the morning. There may be children listening, but they are satanic. But we shouldn't be surprised. Mockery comes straight from hell. Mockery is unfiltered from the satanic depths. That I am sure of. Just think about it in the Bible. Who are the mockers? The mockers are the people who condemn Jesus to death. The mockers are the people who refuse to believe the miracles that are done in front of their eyes. The mockers are the people who constantly undermine our Lord, who he is, where he's come from, his lack of learning, whatever it happens to be. Now, as to Bishop Barron's point about the rabbis and the imams and why they don't mock them, well, I would have thought it's obvious. It's very, very clear why they don't mock the Jews and the Muslims and the Buddhists and every other faith in the world. That's because you and I know that our faith is the real one, the truth. And we know that we are engaged in a perpetual battle until the last day with an enemy. And he knows who his real enemy is. And that is the truth of our holy Catholic faith. Christianity, for want of a better word, is the true enemy of that certain individual. But listen, leaving the theological ramifications aside, let's look at it again in terms of the Bible. There's another verse from the Bible that comes to mind. It sprang out at me this morning when I was thinking about this whole sorry episode. And I'm sure you know Galatians chapter 6, verse 7, but it says the following, do not be deceived. Be under no illusion, is what St. Paul is writing to the Galatians. He said, God is not mocked. Can also be translated as God will not be mocked. He does not stand to be mocked. He is God, remember. And then it goes on to say in the same verse, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. So listen, I don't get annoyed with the mockers. I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for them because they are playing with fire. Yes, that type of fire, quite literally. And they need to be very, very careful. You mock God, no good will come of it. You adore and worship the true God, something good will happen in your life. That is a spiritual fact. As sure as the law of physics or anything else, we have our own spiritual laws of the universe. And to mock God is a very, very dangerous place to be in. Now, you might say, well, that's okay for you, Kevin. That's religion. Why are you talking religion? Okay, if I wasn't talking religion, if I was a total atheist, I would still be saying to the LA Dodgers, you should think about this before you get involved in these culture wars, so-called. Why? Well, you might want to have a little chat with the people over at Bud Light. Heard of them? I'm not going to go into their problems with their flirtations with the culture of death, but it's the same sort of thing, right? Well, Anheuser-Busch, the parent company for Bud Light that own all of those alcoholic beverages, their stock has lost, get this, $27 billion since the start of that particular incident. $27 billion. Bud Light, the parent company, its sales of Bud Light have gone down by 30% and don't appear to be increasing anytime soon. So much so that they're about to lose what's known as shelf space. If people don't buy something in your local supermarket, eventually the people who own the supermarket say, well, we need to put something on the shelves that people do want to buy. And that spells the end of Bud Light. $27 billion. I wonder whenever the people were thinking of deciding to go down the track they went with Bud Light, And they thought it would be a great sales whiz. It would appeal to all those people who don't drink Bud Light. It would appeal to all those people who they thought would be their next customers. Well, I'm sure that whoever was the smart person thinking that didn't think that it would cost the company $27 billion. Now, that is not small change. Or the LA Dodgers might want to talk to the people over at Target. You've heard about them and their clothesline for children, which should not be anywhere near children. You've heard about this, I'm sure. I'm not going to give them the publicity of saying what it is that they're promoting, because it's not something you or I are ever going to buy. So don't worry about that. Now, before Target embarked on this misguided event or line, retailing line for the month of June, what they term Pride Month, the CEO, Mr. Brian Cornell, defended the direction that Target was going in because he said, get this, that it was a good business decision. Good business decision. I'm not sure what business decision, but anyway, good business decision. He went on to add, it's the right thing for society. Really? News to me. And it's the great thing for our brand. Pride and vanity, Mr. Cornell, pride and vanity. Because Target stock so far has lost, guess what? $13.8 billion over the past 2 weeks and is still falling. And a healthy boycott of sales is taking place at Target as well. So how's that good business decision working out for you, Mr. Cornell? Let's go back to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 4. Humility and fear of the Lord bring three things, the book says. Wealth, honor, and life. And I would say that when it comes to Bud Light or Target, we are seeing the opposite of wealth, honor, and life. We're seeing that pride and vanity drags you in a whole different direction and has no concern for who you are, what you are. It only wants to destroy, because ultimately that's where it is coming from, the destroyer. Now, I came across a story which is a wonderful corollary to all of this, and it involves humility. Remember, we are celebrating this month of June as the month of the Sacred Heart, which is the humble heart of Jesus. And I came across the story of Rehan Staten. Now, Rehan Staten lives in Maryland, and a few years ago, he was into martial arts of various sorts, but he was badly injured. After winning a number of competitions, he had a rotator cuff injury, which put him out of the game permanently. And his grades at school, etc., were particularly bad, and he was rejected from every college he tried to apply for. So what did young Rehan do? Well, he had to do something because his father had just had a stroke. So young Rehan decided to get a job as a sanitation worker, getting up at 4 a.m. every single morning to go out and empty bins and trash and garbage. And that's what he did. But at the same time, he continued to study. He continued to hope that what he believed his gifts would come to some fruition. But he did feel that he was at rock bottom. But, and here's the nice thing, his fellow workers in the sanitation department encouraged him. They believed in him. So he began to believe in himself. And guess what? Young Rehan has just gone to Harvard Law School. He went to college, and now he's at Harvard Law School, and he is very, very happy there. Now, I don't know about you, but that's a sign of a young man who humbled himself, and then, no doubt, the Lord blessed him with honor, prosperity, and ultimately life. And I'm sure his father is very, very proud of him. So, the moral of the story is, pride and vanity lead you in the wrong path. But humility and modesty, as this young man demonstrates, will always lead you somewhere good, even if it's very unexpected. 1 minute a sanitation worker, the next minute Harvard Law School. Okay, That's it from me this morning. Now, when we come back, we are going to be meeting somebody who has followed his gifts and given much to us. He is Mark Nowakowski, and he is one of this crop of Catholic composers who are currently hitting the charts right, left and center with their discs. But they're not just hitting the charts, they're topping the charts. So we meet Mark after these words. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here on Archangel Radio. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency with me, your host, Kevin Turley, here on this Thursday morning. I really do hope your Thursday morning is going wonderfully well, wherever you are and wherever you're listening to the show. Now, there is something afoot in the world of classical music here in the United States. We've spoken on this show with Catholic composers like Michael Kerak and Frank LaRocca about their recent unexpected chart-topping successes. While all the time, they are still approaching their music from a very Catholic perspective. Well, today we meet another U.S. Catholic composer who is finding success. Mark Nowakowski is a composer whose works have been performed by such notable artists as the Kronos Quartet, the Cleveland Chamber Symphony, and the Cilician Quartet. His 2017 debut disc on Naxos, Blood Forgotten, received the praise of Gramophone magazine for its, quotes, intense emotional worlds. And I would agree with that. Blood Forgotten was one of those pieces of music that got me through lockdown. Now, just last month, Mark's latest disc, Metanoia, debuted at number one on Amazon's hot new releases in the classical domain. Quite an achievement. And Mark joins me down the line this morning. Mark, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be on your show this morning.
Mark, what did it feel like when you opened up your computer and saw you'd hit number one on Amazon's hot new releases?
It was a little bit of a shock, honestly, because we've gotten a little bit of press from various Catholic outlets, and some of my own, you know, self promo engine was working, and the CD had hit number 9, the physical CD, and then the digital had hit number 7, and began to dip after that. And I thought, well, that's a really great accomplishment for a CD with a big glowing cross on the cover released through a secondary publisher.
Seems to have lost Mark there. We'll try to get him back there.
All right. While we're getting Mark back, I tell you what we could do, Mike. We could play a little bit of Mark's music just while we're loading him up there again, if that's possible.
Absolutely. First. Absolutely.
So just sit back for a moment and listen to a bit of Metanoia now. This is Mark's latest chart-topping success. We'll just play you a little bit, and we'll keep playing it until we get Mark back, and then we'll bring him on again.
Here we go.
who is our guest, and I hope and believe we have Mark back on the line.
Yes, Mark, we do.
Great. Yes. Mark, you're still there, I believe.
Yes, I am. I hope I'm there, and I hope I still this time. It's funny, I never do drop calls except for now. So,
We expect that on Catholic Media. We have many friends in high places, but we've got a few in low places as well. So, Mark, you were just talking about the experience of finding. So your disc was beginning to dip, you were saying. So it had entered into
hit number
the charts
seven and
at a
nine.
Very respectable distance, and suddenly it was starting to dip. But what happened next?
Well, it kind of went down to 70, 80, 90, 100, fell off the chart. It was off for about a day. And so I stopped checking, and I was very happy with the success. And then one day I happened to click a couple of days later, and I saw that it was back in the top 10, and then it hit number 3. And it was behind a commercial effort, and number 1 was Wynton Marsalis, the legendary Wynton Marsalis. Mm. So I said, well, I'm never going to jump ahead of Mr. Marsalis, which is probably a good thing. And that's a much greater success than I thought. And then it jumped into number 1, and it played this game where it would stay at number 1 for a couple of days and drop and come back up, which is very hard to believe. But I felt very blessed, and there was definitely more than, I think, my own efforts behind that at that point.
Well, tell us a little bit about the disc. I was listening to it this morning in anticipation of our meeting, Mark, and I was completely caught up in it. I mean, just to let our listener know, I've interviewed Mark a number of years ago for the National Catholic Register, and really started listening to Mark's music about then. And as I say, that became very much a sort of soundtrack for the pandemic and the lockdown, your Blood Forgotten disc in particular. So, how did this particular piece of metanoia come about, this particular piece of music, which I have to say I was very, very much taken with today?
Well, Metanoia is the first piece on the CD. The CD overall represents a putting together of numerous efforts, I'd say, over the past 6 years, ever since the first disc came out in 2017. And a lot of it I ended up working on, either composing new pieces or editing existing recordings during the pandemic. So it's a little bit of the fruit of the pandemic as well. And I believe we spoke shortly before the pandemic. And ultimately, the challenge became to take these disparate projects and put them together in a thematic way which made sense, which laid out a musical path for the listener to listen to. And there's a variety of types and genres and instrumentations on here. So that was a bit of a challenge. I settled on these pieces that are on the CD. Metanoia is the first piece on the CD. I think I purposefully, especially for my Catholic listeners, put the most challenging work first, right? I always want to challenge the notion that that classical music is merely peaceful music or easy listening music. It's I think it is more properly understood in the context of spiritual narrative. And the title Metanoia is one I decided on after reading a commentary. I don't remember when. I'd always been on the impression that the word metanoia, as it is often translated in scripture, meant repent.
That's right.
But I remember this particular commentator said that it goes a little bit deeper than that. It goes into changing your way of thinking, changing your way of being, and which struck me as a very difficult command for Christ, but also one that takes one on such an introspective journey that it relates very well to music. So at that time, I had gotten the call from a cello octet in Bolzano, Italy. It was all graduate students studying cello, and they called themselves the Monteverde Cello Octet. And they said, will you write a piece for us? And I said, sure, how ambitious can I be? They said, just go for it. And so I said, well, I'll pick this ambitious topic, this ambitious title of Metanoia, and try to pour my own spiritual narrative, my own sort of journey, if you will. And so I think the piece may start a little bit in a difficult sense for some folks, because it is about a 4-minute build, and it's very slow music. It's a little bit anguished. And so what I've been telling listeners, and I'm working on an article about it as well, is think of your own prayer life, right? We don't experience all major keys. We don't experience all consolation. The path to the sun shining through the clouds, if you will, is often fraught with difficulty and struggle of various kinds. And I think that's what the piece represents. It leads up to a moment
where you receive perhaps the intimation of an ultimate spiritual victory, but then you're brought back down to earth because you have a journey to continue. So there's a consolation embedded therein, but it's earned. So I think that's perhaps a spiritual description of the piece.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to leave the listener with the impression that the music is sort of inaccessible, or it's complex, and it's I would say it's compelling. I mean, it may not be the easiest listen to, certainly on the first occasion, but it's something which kind of draws you in. I mean, just in terms of classical music, I mean, where would it be positioned? So somebody likes their Bach or their Mozart or their Beethoven. I mean, this is very much sort of in the school of the kind of Goretzkys, the Arvo Pärt, the John Taverners. Would that be a fair positing of your work, Mark?
I'd be honored by such a positing. Those composers, I discovered them somewhere in the midst of my studies, and my studies were initially all run by modernists, and it sat very badly with me, and I kept studying composition because that was the only avenue through which to do it. But then I discovered these composers whose names we were at the time not allowed to mention in the halls of academia. And they were, Taverner, Pärt, Goretzky, European Christians. So you have a Catholic and two Orthodox in that case. And they, I believe, in America at the time, we were dealing with the rise of minimalism. And I've always understood minimalism as sort of a tonal reset button from the full range of experimentation and avant-gardism that had gone in the country. But it sort of lacked the soul, oftentimes, to my way of hearing, wherein the Eastern European composers locked behind the Iron Curtain, their expression naturally turned religious. And I think they hit the reset button in that sense. And I was one of the biographers of Arvo Pärt. I think some people have called it spiritual minimalism, and it's a term I bristled at. And he more compares it to the visual domain of iconography, where an icon, say an icon of the Blessed Virgin, may seem very simple at first glance, but it is painted over a long period of time. There are many layers, there are shapes, there's depth to it, and it's both a deep technique and a spiritual process. And perhaps some of the surface level strikes us initially as simple, but it gives you a great deal to sink into. And so musically, I've kind of tried to run in the direction that these composers have indicated. And sort of my goal is not to be inaccessible, but to write music that anyone who is able to listen with an open heart can receive a benefit from, some kind of journey from. And that's my hope. I hope that people don't hear it and say, oh, it's ugly modernism. That's my absolute last intention. I really want the listener who is not an aficionado of like the new stream of classical music to be able to access this music and get something from it.
Absolutely. Well, I can absolutely vouch that it is not ugly at all. And I do think you're part of that sort of tradition. And just for anybody who's listening, wondering who these people are, Mark and I are discussing a number of composers that came to prominence at the end of the 20th century, some of whom came from behind the Iron Curtain. They came from communist or totalitarian countries. Or in John Taverner's case, he came from a very secular Britain and a very secular background. But here's the thing. They came to prominence in music, but they all came from very, very devout Christian faith, ultimately. So this was a very strange, this is probably, I don't know if you'd agree with this, Mark, but this is probably one of the reasons why they were a little bit sniffy, as we say, in the establishment, the music establishments, because these people took religion seriously. It wasn't just a backdrop to their music. Now, we're just about to go to a break, Mark. When we come back, I'd like to take this discussion and transplant it into the new world, because there is definitely something happening stateside. We have a number of young Catholic composers coming to the fore at this time, and they're all doing very, very well. So I'd like to take your view on that. If you have any questions for Mark about music, about his music, or anything in particular around the cultural realm, then you can call us on 888-928-0881, or you can text me on 251-928-2111. We'll be back straight after these words. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency. Thank you. Hello and welcome back to Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in conversation with Mark Nowakowski, who is a composer and is celebrating the recent disc Metanoia, which has hit number one on Amazon's Hot New Releases. Mark, we were just discussing before the break this sort of musical renaissance here in Europe, which spread throughout the world at the end of the 20th century, which was a mixture of minimalism and Christianity, whichever way you want to slice that. But there's something seems to be happening in the United States. Would you agree with me?
Absolutely, yes. There is, I think, the heirs, the aesthetic and spiritual heirs of those composers we had discussed have taken heart from their successes. We were speaking of Henryk Gorecki. His Third Symphony became the best-selling symphony of the 20th century. He actually became a millionaire in his retirement age. Arvo Pärt, I think, is still the number one who's still alive. He's still the number one or two most performed composer in the world. Sir James McMillan, a little bit younger than that crowd. He's also one of the top two or three performed composers in the world. And I think a lot of us coming of age in the States, discovering these forbidden voices, if you will, were inspired that we could be, we can embrace tradition and follow their footsteps. And then I think a couple things happened in the church, and one of them was John Paul II's letter to artists, which my experience has been that while a lot of the church has forgotten about it, it's actually very difficult to obtain a printed copy. I tried a few weeks ago. It felt like a thunderbolt among artists of various stripes. And then we had the Benedict XVI pontificate and his clear instruction to musicians to build the sacred music, a new classical music that is coherently emerging out of our tradition and not in opposition to it. In the States, I think our leading light right now is Frank LaRocca. He's based in California. He's a composer in residence for the Benedict XVI Institute for Sacred Music and Divine Worship, which I very much recommend looking into. And they've commissioned under Archbishop Cordiglione several masses from him. I've been out to almost all the premieres and have documented a few of them. His Mass of the Americas was just released, and it hit either number one or number two on Billboard last year and finished in the top 10 of Billboard for classical albums, which I think surprised everybody involved. The music was a very luminous, beautiful, of a high quality. We have Daniel Nags, wonderful choral composer. Jeffrey Quick, also a wonderful composer. Nicholas Lemmy, based out in Nebraska, writes wonderful choral music. An emerging voice now is Bobby Chastain. Through groups like the Benedict XVI Institute, and I'm involved in the board of directors of the Catholic Art Institute, which is centered out of St. John Cantius in Chicago, which is my former parish. There's so much energy in Catholic music, but I would say in Catholic arts in general, and writing, yes, art and architecture and the related disciplines as well. I would even be so bold as to say that we have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to quality artists, and we're a few good patrons away from having our own North American Renaissance. I think the art is already ready to go.
You can never have too much of a good thing, Mark, in any discipline, especially if they're coming with the right ideas and the right thoughts. But the difference, if I may say, I was just listening to you explaining that, Mark. The Renaissance that we were talking about in the late 20th century, mostly European, they were Christian and they wrote sometimes for the church, sometimes they were just writing music and they just happened to come from a Christian base. It seems to me that this latest crop of U.S. Catholic composers, they're much more embedded in, if you like, the liturgy of the church. They're not just playing around with spiritual themes. They're actually sort of embodying the very essence of parts of our holy faith in its liturgy.
Yes, I think there's, and perhaps this is some of the fruits of the Benedict pontificate, as he drew our minds so much towards the liturgy. I think there's a definite movement towards exploring the incarnational reality of our faith, the Eucharistic nature of our faith, the depths of liturgy. And it's probably also no coincidence that I think most of the finest artists in any of these disciplines, there's a very strong devotion to the traditional liturgies, East and West, from which people are drawing sustenance. And I actually have an underdeveloped paper. I go back to every once in a while looking at the form and substance and balance of traditional liturgy and what it can tell us about aesthetics in general and the form that we can embody in our works. And so I think there is that movement, like you're saying, where composers are writing for the Mass or writing music, which emerges liturgically somehow, even if it's not for the Mass. But I think gone is this sort of delineation of sacred and secular, and we're writing sacred music even if it's not for the liturgy explicitly.
Yes, I mean, there's something else which is also happening in the United States at the moment, which is, and you've alluded to it, is this idea of a Eucharistic revival, which will come to its summation next year. But there is something going on here, isn't there, around this Eucharistic revival linked to a sort of renaissance, a revival of the Catholic arts, particularly in music and musical forms, it seems to me.
Yes, in fact, just to give one concrete example, we're working on organizing a series of new pieces to be performed and recorded and distributed virtually based around the Eucharist. So hymns and also simple choral motets, and that is going on through one of the major organizations. I can't give too many more details, but that. But you know, you folks should keep an eye out. There's a real hunger to serve the church and to grow, to, if you will, if I might, regrow the church's aesthetic heritage. You know, there's a sense, I think, that there's a lot of forgetfulness in the post-conciliar period. And just as the arts, the secular arts experimented with form and timbre and note choices and rhythm and forms of serialism, the various modernist schools, I think there's a lot of experimentation in the church with trying to inculcate popular forms. And I think a lot of the Catholic composers today are saying, well, we see that we see the limitations of both approaches, and we're following what Benedict said: go back and let's plant our feet firmly in the tradition. The term I always use is aesthetic magisterium. We speak of the magisterium of the church as a guiding force, and I think the modern Catholic artist of any discipline has an aesthetic magisterium, both by which to be educated and against which to measure their own work and discern a path to beauty.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you're talking about a sort of return to something, because I do know, I mean, having interviewed you before, that you're a revert to the faith. I think Frank LaRocco is as well. I know Michael Kerouac is. They've all been on the show. We've talked about that sort of, it's almost as if their music is part and parcel of, if I may say, metanoia, a return, a repentance, a turning back. Is there something deeply spiritual, do you think, in the music that's being produced, that it is both personal but also national? It's calling for some kind of return to the truth.
Yes, it probably isn't a coincidence that we're converts and reverts. I returned to the faith towards the end of college, and my initial return was prompted both by my studies in music. It's funny that the first place I had discovered the church's sacred music tradition was in the music history classroom. And I remember our professor kept saying, well, those of you who are Catholic would know the following. And I didn't, and you know, even though I no longer considered myself Catholic at that point, but it made me very sad. And I had some studies in philosophy by that point, and my reversion was driven by that and encountering the church fathers, encountering the scholastics. And then returning and looking for where that depth was being expressed in the church. If I may be so bold, I had had enough of sort of the suburban country club church atmosphere, you know, what you find with converts and reverts is you come back intensely looking, just, you know, to duke and ultimate to strike out into the deep, as Catholics in our worship and our prayer. And then, naturally in our art, right? How does something, I think, you know, if there's any young artists listening out there, or people who are discerning a path towards the arts, you know, it's you know that it might be a path for you when you can't conceive of spending too much time doing anything else. And if it's really a fundamental part of how you interact with the world, and for me, sound and the organization of sound was always that. And it was tied up with my prayer life, and it was a form of prayer. And it was, I think, natural that, and I've written this about Frank LaRocca's works as well. He has a wonderful way of, for instance, just to give one example, of taking his own deep plea in prayer, the deep longing and plea that he has, and expressing it in such a personal way that it becomes something that is universally accessible. And I think that's perhaps part of the purpose of the arts, and why God gives us the arts is an artist, whether consciously or unconsciously, can walk a path towards beauty, which I think is a self-revelation of God. And if the artist charts that path, that the work that is left then is a trail that is accessible to anyone else that would follow that same path. And I think that's why these deeply personal works are having sort of a national reverberation, because it's obviously our spiritual yearnings are not unique, and they are being felt all over in these strange times of ours. And if the arts can provide solace and comfort and perhaps organization even to such things, then I think they'll have fulfilled their purpose.
But Mark, I mean, and just I absolutely agree with you, but you said in these strange times, but perhaps that's the reason why we're having this Catholic Renaissance at this time. That's why we're having this great flowering of Catholic music in the United States. It's because of these strange times. Do you ever think that there's no such thing as coincidence in the spiritual life? As John Paul II said, there's no coincidence that we're having this wonderful Catholic musical Renaissance just at a time, maybe when we need it most.
Yes, I think there's no coincidence whatsoever. We were talking earlier about the composers which started this path, the Goretzkys and the Perths, and you know, they were very much, in part at least, reacting towards religious prohibitions set up in Eastern Europe. And I would say that, and perhaps in their time, they had the advantage of having a much clearer picture of good versus evil. Our own time is presented to us as a omnipresent digital glowing paradise, if you will, and yet people are unsettled and they begin to wake up to what's happening around them. And I think the nature of evil is much more amorphous and mm-hmm. clever, if you will, than it was at the end of the previous century with communism. And so this is perhaps why a lot of times, at least initially, intellectual arguments fail, and I've always had a great passion for apologetics and scholastic philosophers, but I notice how difficult it is to bring that into an everyday conversation where beauty is sneakier, perhaps, and it can disarm you with its undeniable authenticity. And so this, I think, is perhaps another reason why the Catholic arts are having such a resurgence at this time.
Absolutely. Well, evil may be all around. It may abound, as the scriptures say, but in such situations, grace multiplies even more, especially on the musical front. Well, we're coming to the end of our interview, unfortunately, Mark. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you again on air. Tell people a little bit, first of all, where they can get a download or purchase a copy of Metanoia, but also tell us a little bit about what else you're planning in the coming months on the musical scene.
Great. Well, I'm finishing a short film score for a little pro-life film called Agonia, being released out of Nebraska by talented young filmmaker Aaron Kessler. We're wrapping that up. There's a vocal quintet, His Majesty's Men, who I'm in residency with. They perform every fall in Chicago at St. John Cantius. So I'm writing my annual piece for them right now, which is a setting of the Ave Maria Stella. And then we've begun doing another score for part three of the Mass of the Ages trilogy for listeners who are familiar with that. And then, you know, other projects reverberating down the line. We're trying to get a four-voice setting of Marian hymns created for a group in Winnipeg. That's still taking shape. In terms of my own music, you can go to my website. That's marknowakowski.com. So Mark with a K, and my last name is spelled Nowakowski. com. I have a Facebook page. You can find me on Twitter. The CD, if you type in Metanoia, you hopefully will come up to it at this point. It used to be way down the list. It isn't anymore. And it's available on Amazon or Apple Music. Or if you go to marknowakowski.substack.com, there are several posts which have links to all the purchase and streaming options. And I will only say to your listeners, and not just for my own benefit, but for my erstwhile colleagues that labor in this discipline, what we've discovered is that classical music now is a small enough discipline where Catholic attention can literally drive the industry and create hits. And Frank LaRocca has experienced that, and I've experienced that recently. And so we're grateful for support Catholics can give us, and we're glad to report that it brings very immediate success, results, rather.
And just say a little bit about the Benedict XVI Institute, Mark, which I know you're intimately involved with.
Yes, they're based out of San Francisco under Archbishop Corbiglione, and the Benedict XVI Institute has really done they've supported all the arts, specifically with music, and they've commissioned some of the works by Frank LaRocca that I spoke of, and have been generous enough to commission a number of us a number of times, concerts, recordings, talks. They're worth looking at very much, and also please look at the Catholic Art Institute coming out of Chicago, which is a little bit more geared towards the visual architecture side. We're doing a lot of music there now as well. We had Sir James McMillan as our keynote speaker last year. So there's and between those two organizations, I think your listeners will find lots to sink their teeth into and take joy in.
Lots and lots to do. Okay, Mark, thank you so much for being on the show this morning. When we come back, we'll be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency.